This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday the 25th of July. I'm your host Shannon Power and this is The Informer, your nightly news and current affairs program.
And I'm Lara Dickinson. On tonight's show we'll be talking to Catherine Barrett, who will tell us about Hold Hands on a Tram, an initiative aimed at recognising the history of lesbophobia experienced by same-sex attracted women that still persists to this day. But first we're having a chat with Liao Youngfa from Ooga Chugga about all his amazing work with the LGBTQIA community in Singapore.
Youngfa, thanks so much for joining us. You run Ooga Chugga in Singapore. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do with that organisation and what that organisation does?
Sure. I'm a registered social worker by training and profession, and Ooga Chugga is a Singapore-based non-profit LGBTQ counselling and support centre. We work with individuals, couples and families who identify anywhere along the LGBTQ plus spectrum, including people who may still be questioning their sexual orientation and or gender identity, their family members, people who identify as gender diverse. And if I'm not wrong, we might be the only, well, quite possibly the only community-based LGBTQ plus counselling and support centre of its kind in Singapore. We've been doing this since 1999, so that makes us about 18 this year.
Wow, okay, so it sounds like it's a very critical organisation to people in Singapore.
So.
give us an idea of what kind of issues or reasons people might come to access your services. And I mean, I'll give us a general idea what life is like for the LGBTIQ people in Singapore.
Sure, just to give you a bit of a context, I was just looking up, just to make sure I get my facts right. Singapore is the only developed Asian country that still criminalizes same-sex relationships. We still have in our statutes a particular piece of legislation called 377A of the Penal Code, which specifically criminalizes same-sex behaviors between adult consenting men. So very specifically, that still exists, a legacy of being a Commonwealth country, I suppose. And however, even though government and parliament have given some kind of a reassurance that it will not be proactively enforced, it does mean that by its very existence, homophobia and transphobia are institutionalized in Singapore. So it's not just that piece of legislation, as you can imagine, and Australia might remember this from many decades ago. Lots of little pieces of legislation are still around that sort of prohibits things from happening, that actively discriminates against LGBTQ plus individuals and couples and even families. So, for example, it may be something like access to healthcare and social services. We know of people who report difficulties accessing healthcare and social services. For example, transgender people who find it hard to access healthcare services and to or basically have who report having rather unpleasant experiences with some healthcare professionals, not all. Another example would be the complete absence of LGBTQ plus affirming sexuality education in our mainstream schools. So that's two of the issues that we are faced with in Singapore. I could go on with a few more. So in terms of the services that we provide, counselling support is very important. A lot of the time we have people coming to us, they talk about sometimes not so positive experiences with other service providers, whether they are in the counselling sector or social services sector, or even sometimes the healthcare sector. And they come to us feeling safe. It could be issues related to family, to relationships, or even to just, you know, questioning, exploring their gender identities or sexual orientation. So for many people, actually, coming to Ugechaga is a preferred choice because they see us as affirming and safe. So relationships, working with families and relationships is a big part of our work. We also work very closely with the community on mental health issues, as well as on top of our counselling services, we also run support groups, as well as conducting professional training courses and workshops for our community partners out there, because much as we want to be the counselling centre of choice for Singapore, we know there are lots of other service providers out there, counsellors and social workers and psychologists, who will be meeting clients on a day-to-day basis, and we want to equip them with the skills, the knowledge, and the confidence to do that as well. So we provide that kind of training. We also engage with our community partners as well as our corporate partners, partly because of fundraising and so partly because we also want to raise awareness in different communities and workplaces as well.
So by the sounds of things, life for LGBTIQA plus people in Singapore can be quite tough. And it's very crucial to have the right kind of support services for them. I'm not sure if this is easy to gauge or not, but do we have any idea what percentage of the population or how many people identify under that umbrella of LGBTIQ?
Well, I suppose to be fair, the experiences of the community in Singapore is a mixed one. Yes, for some people it's tough. For others it's... it's mixed in terms of a proportion. We haven't, that's the thing, we don't have a national census specifically asking questions about sexual orientations and or gender identities. If we were to go by international standards, anything from 3 to 10%, and we have a resident population of about 5.5 million. So I'm not sure what that works out to.
It's hard to say. And what sort of impact would that have, not sort of having clear data on the figures? Does that have any impact on how your ability to provide the right kind of services for people, or are you kind of well-versed enough to get the job done?
Certainly. I mean, just with that question that you asked earlier, it's so hard, in absence of actual data, it's just so hard for us, for example, to advocate for services and planning and to advocate for resources as well. The data we're able to provide are based on our own very small-scale surveys, the data we have based on our own outreach figures, caseload figures, and as you can imagine, that is often very limited as well. So that's what I mean. So in the absence of national data, we're not able to reach out further to advocate for more resources and funds and to tell people, look, there's all these people who might need services and... we need to provide that support and to come in with plans for future services and programs.
Leo Yangfaz, the runs Ugechaga, an LGBTI organisation in Singapore. And we've been hearing a lot of community service ads for your organisation here on Joy in Australia, because we're hearing that you're sort of struggling for finances. And from what you've just said, sounds like it's a bit hard to get your hands on the money that you need to provide the urgent services and critical services for the community there. What do you need? Are you in the middle of a fundraising campaign to keep things going?
And yes, we are actually. We are in the middle of a fundraising campaign, our largest fundraising campaign ever. A bit of background to this. For the past 8 or 9 years or so, we have been in a rather fortunate situation where we've had a single, donor or sponsor who provided about 80% of our funds continuously for the past 8 or 9 years. Sometime last year, they made a decision to cease that funding, and they informed us rather unexpectedly. So literally overnight, we were told we had 80% of our funding cut, and a decision was made internally for us to continue our services, of course. And in the absence of that funding stream, we decided to launch a fundraising campaign, and we've been doing that since late last year. And I suppose just to give a bit of an idea of what we need, in a typical year, we need something like between 200 and 250,000 Singapore dollars, and I think we're sort of on par with Australian dollars, so thereabouts. That's what we need every year. So far, we've met about almost two-thirds of our fundraising target, and that's just an annual fundraising target. So for us, fundraising is an ongoing process, as I'm sure lots of community groups and organizations all across Australia and the world would know as well. It's we want to keep going because we don't want to let our service users down. We do want to keep our programs and services running, and because we find that that's important for us and important for our service users as well.
So what can people do if they want to help out? How can they get some money to help out the critical services that you have there in Singapore?
Well, we've got an online fundraising page, and you can find out about us through our website. It's oogachaga.com, and oogachaga is, as it sounds, oogachaga.com. We actually have portals that allow donations either in cash or through credit card. And I'll just give a quick plug. If you happen to be in Singapore later this year in August, we actually have our first ever fundraising gala dinner, and the theme is Cirque du Soleil Glam. Reason being, we've recently had a Cirque du Soleil circus in town. We thought, well, have a bit of a twist on that, have a circus theme, and we'll call it Cirque du Soleil Glam. So that's my little plug for our fundraising gala.
That's very cute. And just very quickly, Young Fa, can you give us an idea? The name Oogachaga is very unique. Does it have any special meaning?
It does, actually. Some of the listeners might remember the American TV series Ellie McBeal back in the late 90s. And maybe just for the benefit of people who don't know her, Ellie, a main character in the TV series, she's a lawyer and was in a very high-stress job. And whenever she gets stressed out, she has a panic attack, and she would actually either hide in a conference room or in a bedroom if she's at home. And when she has these panic attacks, she would actually have a hallucination. And whenever she hallucinates, a dancing baby, a CGI dancing baby, would appear. And when the baby appears, the song Hooked on the Feeling will come on, and the opening line or chorus is Oogachaga, Oogachaga. So that's the tribal chant. So when the founders of Oogachaga were looking for a name to call the group back then, they decided, well, let's call the group Oogachaga. It's a reminder of that dancing baby, and the dancing baby sort of represents, well, different things for different people. For some people, it's about the inner self. So for some people, it represents those things that we hide or unexpected things that we do not want to reveal or disclose by ourselves. And yet, it's also a reminder that sometimes when we least expect it, the dancing baby may reappear or emerge. And a reminder for us to embrace that dancing baby whenever they appear. So that's the story behind Oogachaga.
Oh, that is adorable, Young Fa. Congratulations on all the hard work that you do for the LGBTIQA plus community in Singapore. And we hope that people will be able to, give you a few dollars to help you continue the very vital work that it is that you do. And thank you for joining us on The Informer.
Thank you so much, Shannon. Thank you, Joy.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Alice's Garage is a project that seeks to empower members of the LGBTQIA community, especially the elders to whom we owe so much. They have started some incredibly important initiatives, including the Tango Project, aimed at increasing the accessibility of information and services to LGBTQIA elders, and 100 Years of Love, which celebrates the love and lives of three rural lesbian couples. Hold Hands on a Tram is the most recent of their initiatives.
Catherine, thanks for joining us on The Informer. Now, I've noticed a hashtag popping up on my social media called, Women Holding Hands, and it's gorgeous. It's, lesbians and same-sex attracted women, I guess, appearing in photos on trams and around Melbourne. I think you're the brains behind this. Can you tell me a little bit more about it, please?
I'm glad it's popping up on your newsfeed. That's fantastic. It means that we're getting closer to doing our job well. This is a project that's a collaboration between Alice's Garage, the social photographer, Switchboard Victoria, and in partnership with the City of Port Melbourne as well too. And the idea for it came from last year in Victoria, Premier Daniel Andrews, in his apology to gay and bisexual men for criminalised sexuality, told the story of two women in 1976 who were charged, who were convicted of offensive behaviour for holding hands on a tram. So that's a little known fact, I think, about our history in Victoria. And I think we tend to think of histories as kind of talk about them in collective ways, but actually the experiences of each of the LGBTI subgroups are really quite different. And so this project is focusing particularly on lesbians' experiences of lesbophobia.
And is there sort of, I guess, you know, you've just said different groups had different experiences, but for lesbians in the days where, you know, their sexuality was criminalised, was there, I guess, a universality to the discrimination they faced?
Well, in fact, my understanding is that lesbian sexuality was not criminalised, but that didn't mean that lesbians weren't persecuted or face extraordinary discrimination. So we know of lesbians that were given conversion therapies and who lost their jobs and, you know, who were beaten up and who had all those dreadful experiences that we know that gay men had as well. I think one of the things that we need to understand, and why there's a whole movement now to recognise the word lesbophobia rather than refer to the experiences lesbians had as homophobia, is because there's this issue of sexism in there as well too. So two women in the 70s, could not get a bank loan without a male guarantor, you know, such as the history of sexism in our community, that there were different issues that faced as same-sex women in a couple than men. And I think that's it's really important we understand that.
Well, yeah, so women, I guess, were facing, as we call it, lesbophobia, but that ties into not only their sexuality but sexism against women generally in the community. Now, a lot of these women are older, and we could, say that society is a little bit more accepting, or a lot more accepting than maybe a few decades ago. But I imagine there's still some impact on the older generations who went through this stigma and persecution. Are you seeing the effects of that in the work that you do?
Look, absolutely seeing the effects. I think one of the things that I notice is there's not a sense of entitlement. You know, so the older lesbians, some of them that I speak to are, you know, fabulous and feisty and have become really good at asserting themselves and asserting their rights. And there are a number of others whose lifetime experiences meant the only way they could make themselves safe was to sort of fly under the radar and make their sexuality and their relationships invisible. And this is a group of people in particular that I'm working with now who may be having challenges with their adult children who don't approve of their sexuality or their same-sex relationships and never did, particularly those who've come out late. And they're also people who may be accessing aged care services and feeling, you know, really concerned that they're not going to be able to, that they'll have to go into a closet or they'll have to straighten up their home. So there is a legacy for older lesbians today of those historical experiences. But one of the really interesting things for me has been in the taking of some of the photographs and holding hands with friends in the street or in a tram stop or in the local gym has been how people have stared at us. And it's made me really conscious of the fact that I think that lesbophobia is, as William Faulkner would say, the past is not dead, it is not even past. You know, I don't think we've completely moved away to a place where people are really embracing of lesbian sexualities. We're not there yet, and I've certainly seen that with this project and with the photos that are taken. And in fact, we were saying yesterday, part of the project team, that maybe what we might do is put another component to this project up on the webpage that invites particularly straight folk, particularly straight women, or even two men, to go out there and hold hands in a public place and look at the response from the community, because, you know, I've really felt the stares and really felt people's kind of guarded responses, hey, what's happening here, and are you two lesbians? And of course we are, and we're proud of that, but there is certainly a message there that that not everybody's comfortable with it yet.
Right. I think that's a really great point, is to maybe not only support the online campaign, but also to get out there and experience what the kind of discrimination is like, or the feeling of stigma is like for yourself. So in terms of a call to action, what do you want from the community? Do you want to see the hashtag popping up more online? Tell us about this tram ride as well that's happening.
Yeah, but we do want to see the hashtag popping up more online. And, I'm meeting with my, catching up with my mum on Friday, and I want to take a picture holding hands with my mum. And so I think any women that are out there that could take a picture holding hands as a show of solidarity. You don't have to be a lesbian to be holding hands. The invitation is really around solidarity. The next invitation is around particularly younger, middle-aged and mature-aged lesbians going out and having a conversation with an older lesbian and saying, tell me about your experiences. Not only what was it like, what was your experience of lesbophobia, but what was your resistance? What did you do to resist those discriminatory views and perspectives? So that's the second invitation. And the third invitation is we have a tram ride. So we're getting together with a group of lesbian elders in October for a seniors festival, and we're going to jump on a tram, lots of hand-holding, and we've got the fabulous photographer, the special photographer Lisa White there. She'll take a series of photographs, particularly of older lesbians holding hands on a tram, and that's both a show of resistance and standing up and saying, that we don't stand for lesbophobia. But it's also too a show of solidarity and recognition of the histories that older lesbians have lived through.
Well, I think that's fantastic, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us on The Informer. And if people want to find out more information about the project and what they can do to get involved, they can head to alicesgarage.net. And not only is this a great form of resistance and I guess raising awareness of historical lesbophobia, but it's also really cute and gorgeous. I love the idea. I think it's fantastic. And thanks for joining us on The Informer.
Thanks, Jen and Ruthie.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
You are on The Informer on Joy 94.9. This is Shannon Power, and I just thought I'd flip the table a little bit on our host tonight. Lara is a new recruit here at Joy. He's just recently completed the Joy radio training course. And I wanted to ask you, Lara, why did you come to Joy to learn about radio?
Well, initially I was asked to do a on-air guest spot on Unicorn Youth here. I've been listening to Joy since I was in high school. I think it's a really great initiative. I think it's really good for the community. I noticed that there weren't many trans people on the air, so I figured I would come and lend a little more of a diverse voice.
Totally. And you just did the radio training course. What did you want to get out of that?
Just to learn how to present, how to do all the technical stuff, get more sort of ingrained in the community, meet everybody who works here. Just check it out, really.
Yeah, right. And how did you find out about it, though? Like, is it something you already knew about, or...?
Actually, no. After I had been on Unicorn Youth a couple of times, the person who runs that just offered me a spot in it and said that she would try to get me a scholarship and get me into it.
Fantastic. And that's, of course, the amazing Delcy, who also kind of organises or teaches a lot of the Joy radio training. And now you've put your hat in the ring to come and help us on The Informer, which, we are looking for new volunteers to help out on the show. Mm-hmm. What was it about The Informer that you wanted to get involved with?
Well, I've always been interested in politics. I love talking to politicians and sort of trying to hold them accountable for various things that they say. I have a long history of doing that just on my own time. I figured I might as well go public with it because really I'm I come up with quite a lot of good insults for them. Not that that will go on air, but.
Yes, but, you know, and then that's good to have, I guess, a wide range of voices doing the news as well here on The Informer.
Absolutely.
And what sort of, what's your long-term plan for Joy? Just plodding along for now and seeing where you land.
Yeah, I'd like to see just more trans content on Joy. I'd like to get a trans-specific show going. I'd love to do just as much as I can with The Informer, get some journo experience, maybe take that a bit further, who knows?
Yeah, fantastic. And it's great to have a younger person's voice as well on Joy, and doing a, you know, trans stories would be fantastic. Mm. Well, Lara, congratulations on your first night hosting.
Thank you very much.
And welcome to Joy, and welcome to The Informer.
Thank you.
That's it for another episode of The Informer. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. to bring you the day's big news from an LGBTIQ perspective.
Thanks to tonight's guests, Youngfa and Catherine, for chatting to us tonight and for making such important contributions to the LGBTQIA community. My name is Lara Dickinson. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform.
If you love the news and you'd like to become a part of the Joy 94.9 family, we have a few volunteer vacancies on the Informer team. We're looking for presenters, producers, panelists, podcasters, and social media masters. If you love the Informer and would like to get involved, we'd love to have you. Email us at theinformer@joy.org.au if you'd like to get involved. My name's Shannon Power. There's more Informer tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Coming up next on Joy 94.9 is the news, followed by World Wide Wave.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.